Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, KLW's weekly radio magazine of the performing arts. I'm your host, David Latulli, providing a little fresh air, I guess, from the hearings for this hour. I'll be talking with cellist and singer Amanda Zaido, who plays the role of Queen Prospera in Cirque du Soleil's latest production, Amaluna, currently visiting the Bay Area. Also a conversation with Celine Ricci, artistic director of San Francisco-based opera company Ars Minerva, devoted to resurrecting forgotten operas from the Italian Baroque. The conductor of the opera also joins us in studio. We'll also be talking with Jori Vinicor. Also have a conversation with Norwegian pianist Leif Ove Andsnes upon his return to Davies Symphony Hall to perform Mozart's Piano Concerto No. 2 with conductor Manfred Honeck and the San Francisco Symphony. Also on the program, Bruckner's Fourth Symphony. And Open Air's regular contributor and critic at large, Peter Robinson, discusses the art of memoir writing for those who want to take Thanksgiving as an opportunity to start writing your own family story. Plus a review of the third season of The Crown on Netflix. Stay with us. Guitar to harpsichord to introduce this first segment of Open Air. Ars Minerva, a Bay Area nonprofit devoted to resurrecting forgotten operas from the Italian Baroque, is presenting Domenico Fresci's Ermelinda this weekend at ODC Theater in San Francisco, Friday and Saturday at 7:30, Sunday afternoon at 2:30. The artistic director joins me in studio, mezzo-soprano Celine Ricci, also executive director of Ars Minerva, where she sang in and directed several productions. She was born in Florence, Italy, and later studied in Paris and London, later recognized by renowned conductor William Christie for his academy. She's been heard around the world, the country, and around the bay, as during the 2016-17 season, she sang Nero in the West Edge opera production of Agrippina, and also with Ars Lyrica at the Berkeley Early Music Festival. Conducting the opera from the harpsichord is multi-Grammy-nominated Jori Vinicor, who also joins me in studio, and we're hearing him in the background performing some Couperin. Jori is recognized as one of the outstanding harpsichordists of his generation and has cultivated a highly diversified worldwide performing career as concerto soloist, accompanist, and conductor, as well as a recording artist. As you hear, among his many recordings is a recording of Bach's Goldberg Variations on Delos, was named by the Chicago Tribune as one of 2001's top 10 classical CDs, with similar honors bestowed on his recording of Bach's toccatas. Locally, he has conducted performances of Handel's Saul with Philharmonia Baroque and led the West Edge Opera aforementioned production of Handel's Agrippina. He will correct me on some of that in a moment. An extension of his widely respected endeavors, both harpsichordist and conductor, Jori is a big advocate for historically informed performance practices. Jori, welcome to Open Air.
Thank you for having me.
And maybe offering me that correction.
just to say that Saul by Handel, I was thrilled to play organ and the carillon, the bells, under the direction
Nicholas
of the wonderful
McGee,
Nicholas McGee, yeah, okay. My dear friend.
Wouldn't want to upstage him.
No.
Need to keep him
no.
In good graces. Hey,
what's this? Nick, I'm sorry if you hear this.
And Celine, welcome to you.
Thank you, David, for inviting us.
Of course. Well, this is the second Ars Minerva production that has its origin story in Venice. Tell us how you and whoever else might have been involved in discovering the music.
So Ars Minerva, we started in 2015. We had some Venetian opera, and last year we had an opera from that was actually premiered in Munich by still a Venetian composer. And so when I started Ars Minerva, I really wanted to recreate operas because when I was performing as a singer, I've had the privilege and opportunity to be involved in many opera recreations. And so I've been researching during some years, and I've been creating files in my computer where I've stored quite a bit of operas, and especially from Venice, yes. Mm-hmm.
So what kind of shape are these in? Have these already been discovered and properly notated? Or are we looking at original manuscripts that still have the ink stains on them?
Exactly. We are looking at manuscripts that have ink and mistakes, sometimes also other notes written on them. And so we need a little bit to...
Missing parts within in vocal lines occasionally.
Yes.
Is the musical nomenclature the same from 1600s Vienna, or is there actually we've got to translate it for a modern musician to interpret?
No, it's we need to do a modern score.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And what sort of differences does one see?
Although the basic nomenclature, as you put it, can remain rather the same. We have certain rhythmic quirks. For instance, in early Italian music, note values tend to be doubled, which can be rather off-putting to the modern musician. Measure lines are frequently differently stated, which is not necessarily such a major ordeal. And in the type of manuscript that Celine provided, it's been very hastily noted on paper. It's not certain to me what was used as performance material in 1680. So although a musicologist, I think in Poland, prepared this in modern score, I nonetheless spent many hours, not only correcting over this gentleman's back, but even just going back into the original score and trying to find the composer's intentions.
Mm. And also about the manuscript. This manuscript is from the... Collezione Contarini. So the collection is at the Biblioteca Marciana, and Marco Contarini was a noble Venetian man who collected all those manuscripts in the 17th century, including the Coronazione di Poppea, Monteverdi, and his family kept everything during two centuries, and in the 19th century they donated everything to Biblioteca Marciana.
Wow.
Where it's still now.
That must be a treasure trove.
It's really a treasure because these are the really original, and thank God Marco Contarini kept everything. And I would like to add this particular opera, Ermelinda, was actually created in his own theater because he was a big fan of opera.
Wow. Naturally, we're all thinking of Venice at this time of the flooding catastrophe. Let's hope there are no manuscripts hidden in some flooded basement.
Apparently, I don't know, but it's not good.
Frightening, yes. So, Jory Vignacourt, bringing us back to performance practice, you're a big advocate for making sure things are done right, but how do we know that things are done right? And how long a note should be held?
All of this is so subjective. I am not somebody who has buried my head in treatises and doctrines for years. A lot of this is based on practice where I, too, like Celine, I've worked with some of the finest musicians, have been able to ascertain what I find convincing, what coming from certain other conductors or groups I find less convincing. And for instance, when we work in recitativo passages, this is to say operas of Monteverdi, so going back even to the very beginning of 17th century, going all the way even, say, into the Mozart da Ponte operas, when we see very, very long bass notes written for all the recitatives, I think we've kind of figured out, well, yes, it's kind of the structure harmonically of these pages of music, but it behooves the person playing, be it fortepiano or harpsichord or theorbos and so forth, to find out what are the real lengths of these notes. How do we punctuate what the singers are speaking about? How do we underline this, heighten it? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So there's a lot of decision making to be made. Some of it I have kind of done what is the word, de facto, but before my partners ever get their hands on the music. Uh-huh. So I've treated some of it in advance of that, and others we discovered together.
Right, right. And Celine, as a vocalist, ornamentation, is that something that is added spontaneously or is thought out in advance for the most part for these performances?
So, of course, it depends. Normally, I mean, in the past, we know that singers could improvise every night something different. For this kind of opera, 17th century opera, these are not big arias like for Handel or for Vivaldi, where you really have a da capo and that has to be very ornamented. These are really little ornaments. It's not a lot, and so it's more about appoggiaturas, a little fioritura around the note, mm-hmm. But of course, normally a singer is in style is allowed to change every night if she wants. That's the tradition if you stay in style.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. So one by one, as these are being discovered and the coffee stains are being removed and the missing parts are added, are definitive performing editions then being provided and stored in a library proper?
So what we have is in my computer and printed. I would love in the future to be able to really go over all the operas we did, really making lots of edits, because we always find mistakes. It takes some years to have really a great critical edition, mm-hmm. and maybe being able one day to have Ars Minerva also edition.
Yeah, sure.
But so hopefully... We need more fundraising for that.
You hear people out there.
If I'd add to that, since this is my first experience with Ars Minerva and doing the Sir Melinda, I've provided my own performing edition, which is very different than a kind of urtext edition. In other words, I've already edited bass notes. I've added, when Sagan spoke about vocal ornamentation, for the few pieces that do require anything, I sort of added it, where even... You were initially unaware of things which came from me and not the composer. And in a proper or text edition, these can be put in the back as an index, but I would have to re-prepare something which simply reflects the composer's score and not the way we came together to perform it.
Mm-hmm. So tell us a little bit about the composer Domenico Fresci, 16 operas, some extant sacred music, which is probably helpful for interpretation.
Yeah, so 16 operas, and actually I would like to say 15, because this is so very funny. 3 years ago we played La Circe. La Biblioteca Marciana in Venice says that it's from Domenico Fresci, but it's actually Pietro Andrea Ziani.
Italian scandal.
I told them, because actually Fresci also wrote Circe, but it's not the one they think they have. The one they have, it's Pietro Andrea Ziani. And now that we are recreating a Fresci, the style is very different, and I'm sure that the Circe they have is the Ziani, not the Fresci. So 15 operas and 11 still alive, and I have some of them. Hopefully we'll be able to do them as we go. So Fresci was actually, during 5 years, the director of this private theater of Marco Contarini.
As an ordained priest as well.
Yeah. And also he was a priest. He was a priest and composer for the church. I don't know his sacred music. And very few pieces of him have been recreated. Mm-hmm. I think that we are the first opera, actually, to be recreated from him.
I believe this absolutely. I've never observed.
And it's a pity, because it's really beautiful. It's a little masterpiece. Ermelinda is a little mm-hmm. masterpiece. It's very clever, and I'm amazed that no one ever did it.
And when Celine shared the score with me, which was already put into a modern notation, so I was able at least to basically easily access my inner ear while reading this, I thought, you know, it's a rather nice piece. I immediately understood its family relation to better known composers like Cavalli or Cesti, but only when I brought the score here to San Francisco and on the first day of rehearsing with our singers and looking at it, I immediately came to Celine's conclusion that this is a genuine forgotten masterpiece, not just a lovely piece. It's extraordinarily adroitly written, going from comedy to somewhat tongue-in-cheek yet sincere tragedy, you know, love lost, love regained, going from amusing to deeply lyric in no time at all.
It's an incredible unique piece. It's really...
Well, let's talk a little bit about the plot line then.
Oh, God, sorry. Please.
All right, let me reestablish here while you think about the bite-sized version of that, talking with Celine Ricci, the artistic director and artistic and executive director of Ars Minerva, along with harpsichordist conductor Jory Vinicor, about this incredible opera that's really been brought to life the first time since 1680, which is just extraordinary to me.
Yes.
So what are we going to hear about in this opera?
So this opera is the story of a young girl, very witty, who, as every young girl, wants to have fun. But her father has not the same view for her. So he brings her far from the city, far from every entertainment and amusement and potential lover, and he brings her to the countryside. And her father is a tyrannical and kind of crazy. And so she's bored. She wants to go back to the court and the city, but he doesn't want. He wants her to stay with two other friends in the countryside, Rosaura and Armidoro. But Ermelinda has a lover in the main city, and the lover is the Prince of Phoenicia. So the Prince of Phoenicia is looking for her, but he has left his prince clothes for a peasant clothes and a peasant attitude.
It's a bit of a trope, by the way.
Yeah.
I should say, yeah.
He's a detective. And so the action is placed in former Phoenicia, which is actual Lebanon.
Oh,
and
okay,
the view
right
for this is kind of Orientalism. So I wanted it to be like the composer and the librettist, Venetian people who dream about Middle East, that have never been to Middle East, and see, you know, Venice, all those boats coming from Middle East and bringing all those amazing things, and people being, oh, this is Middle East. And so imagine Middle East. So this is the vision. It's a comedy with also tragic moments about the Ermelinda who wants to be free, and with the man she loves and her father trying to overprotect her, and even being awful with other two incredible characters around.
And I wonder, and I'd ask Celine, who knows this period so incredibly well, but I'm finding more and more that despite the lightness of this piece, that it really has something to say in feminist terms. I really do think so. Of course, there are many feminine heroes in Baroque operas, thinking of Coronation of Poppea, but she manipulates not out of love, but to gain power. And is powerful by her feminine wiles. Ermelinda, this charming character, really just wants to be free.
Exactly.
And free to love. And she wins by resolution and her fortitude and her fidelity, if I can say that, and not by a stereotypical feminine guiles and wiles. Mm-hmm. It seems to me very interesting.
Yeah, so since the beginning of Ars Minerva, I, on purpose, choose operas that highlight strong women, but in different ways. Our first was Cleopatra. Of course, there is no match with Cleopatra, who still nowadays is the most powerful woman ever, right? But Ermelinda is, in another way, rebellious and want to be herself and not be dictated what she has to do.
We should make a footnote there that this Cleopatra will take second place when the opera of Nancy Pelosi is
La Polizina.
Yes.
Can you sing that, please, Celine?
We should give a shout out to Nicola Prince, who is in the title role.
Oh, Nicola.
Soprano of Ermelinda. The productions are tomorrow and Saturday at 7:30, Sunday afternoon at 2:30. I'm going to leave the last word with you, Jory Vinicor, about the orchestra involved. Any unusual instruments that we'll see? They'll all be original instruments.
But yes, so we're using period instruments. We have a small group. That said, Freschi provides a certain number of orchestral interludes or ritornelli. These are invariably written as four-part strings, so two violins, viola, the basso continuo line, that's to say cello with either theorbo, harpsichord, or both. And I've provided from my own compositional well three ritornelli that I just wanted to have more string writing. And we keep this one player per part, and I can be nearly certain, especially as this was performed in a private theater, that Freschi himself would have used a very small group, maybe or maybe not, with a couple of recorders added. Mm-hmm. So it's a wonderful group of local Bay people.
Great. And English subtitles, I imagine?
Indeed.
Yes.
English subtitles.
ArsMinerva.org for more information. Jory Vinicor. Celine Ricci, thanks so much for coming into the show.
Thank you for inviting us.
Wonderful singing of Nicola Prince in last year's production of Iphigenia. She was singing the role of King Amenemnon. Once again, Ermelinda is at ODC Theater tomorrow, Saturday at 7:30, Sunday at 2:30. Information at arsminerva.org. A very good afternoon to you. I'm David LaTulipe. Still to come, Peter Robinson will offer some advice on how to make your own family memoir in the art of memoir writing, and a review of The Crown on Netflix. I'll also speak with pianist Leif Ove Andsnes with the San Francisco Symphony this week. Well, Cirque du Soleil's latest show, Amaluna, has been playing under the big top at Oracle Park in San Francisco since November 7th, and as usual, is quite a sight. As with any Cirque production I've seen, the storyline seems secondary to the amazing gravity-defying acrobatics that you'll see under the very big top. But here's the premise of the latest show, now running through January 12th. The scene, a mysterious island ruled by goddesses. After directing her daughter's coming-of-age ceremony, honoring femininity, renewal, rebirth, and balance, Queen Prospera causes a storm. A group of young men wash up on the isle, triggering an epic love story between Prospera's daughter and a brave young suitor. Theirs is a love that will be tested. Well, originally composed of some 20 street performers in 1984, Cirque du Soleil Entertainment Group has completely reinvented circus arts and went on to become a world leader in live entertainment. Established in Montreal, the Canadian organization has brought wonder and delight to over 200 million spectators and has performed in some 450 cities in 60 countries. The organization currently has over 4,500 employees, including 1,400 artists from nearly 70 countries. One of those employees joins me today in studio. In fact, the leading on-stage role.
It's nice to see and hear a musician in the lead role, that of Queen Prospera, no less. And she and her colorful cello and beautiful voice make for quite an impression on stage, and I'm very pleased that she's joined me in studio. Amanda Zidow hails from L.A., where she worked as a freelance musician, recording for TV, cartoons, and video games. At the ripe old age of 16, she began touring Europe and Asia, performing with various orchestras and pop bands, and has been with Cirque since 2011. Welcome, Amanda.
Thank you for having me.
And a stunning production. I mean, and you look spectacular up there.
Thank
it must
you.
Be nice to have a leading role now. Tell us first about the cello you're wielding. It's quite an instrument.
Yes, it is. It is a carbon fiber, Lewis and Clark. The thing that makes it unique is that I actually have to walk around on stage while playing. So there's a harness that's fitted to the cello.
Right.
And it stays on my left shoulder, so it kind of hangs on my left shoulder, and I walk around stage playing and singing.
And it's blue.
And it's painted blue. Yeah, blue and gold to match the, you know, the colors of the show.
Yeah. There's a full live band behind you as well, mm-hmm. In various incarnations. Now, would it be betraying a trade secret if I asked if any of your cello playing is pre-recorded? Is it all live?
It is all live.
Wow.
Yes. It's all live. Yeah.
And so tell us about the score itself then and the composer.
Well, it's two composers, actually, Bob and Bill. They're they've composed a few Cirque du Soleil shows. And for this show, what they really wanted to do was, first of all, it's an all-female band, and they really wanted to highlight...
It seems to be a highlight at today's show, strong women.
Yes, I noticed that. we're their first Cirque du Soleil band to have all females, and they really wanted to do something different with this show, with the music. Cirque du Soleil generally has what I would say like a world sound, worldly music. Kind of sound like something ethereal and otherworldly. But with this show, they kind of wanted it more to be, I would say, more rock. There are elements, of course, of some ethereal songs in there, but it's mainly rock. It's really showcasing, you know, we've got two guitarists, we've got bass, we've got drums and percussion, and the girls are just really rocking out on stage.
And tell me about your transition. How did you audition for this? Did you have to go through some physical? I mean, you're obviously a fine cellist. They knew that from other productions. What was it like to finally land a role that's on stage so prominently?
Yeah, this was because the first show that I did with them was just cello, and Danny Elfman had composed the music for this one. So it was very much more, I would say, closer to classical, you know, and movie music, and. So, and I was also playing keyboards on that show. But for this one, it was a singer-cellist role plus character work. So there was acting involved. I had never done that before, along with playing cello. I, you know, of course, in music school, you do vocal performance as well. But I had never actually done all three at the same time. So I went through a lot of training in Montreal at the headquarters, and they prepared me very well for this role.
Nice. Is there any improvisation involved, or is it all established?
It's mainly established, yes. You know, because we're working with acrobats, and we are following what's happening on stage. So if a trick goes wrong, let's say, or if something's not ready, you know, with an aerial act, and it's going to take a while for something to be ready.
It's funny you mentioned that, because I saw the show last night, and I had a dream of the show last night where someone made an error, but they didn't make any errors in last night's show. But it's funny, my dream showed that.
You saw it last night, which is funny, because last night, actually, there was a part where I did have to improvise a little, because there's a part where these poles come down from the air, and these girls are just hanging on these poles, and
they weren't ready yet. The Poles weren't ready. So they, in my ears, they told me to, we need a vamp. We need a vamp. So I just, you know, just improvised a little before that. And then they tell me, okay, we're ready. Okay, pick it up from the top.
Yeah, we should mention that you're not on a unicycle. You're not being jettisoned into the air by a castmate or being spun from the ceiling on a rope, all of which you'll see.
Not yet.
You're still very prominently featured as the queen of the production.
Yeah.
There are some truly amazing acrobatics involved in the show, some of which advance the plot, and others maybe not so much, but it's a joy to behold, indeed a secondary to the spectacle. So are you keeping track of the number of shows that you've been performing?
Oh, my God.
I guess not.
No, I haven't kept track personally. I mean, the show has been around for almost 8 years. I've been with them for six of those years. And so definitely have played for upwards of a million people.
Now, you always have the same performance venue in terms of that big top rolls around. But tell us about a city that you especially enjoyed being pitched at.
I would have to say Paris.
Oh, that's
yeah. It's definitely one of my favorite cities, but we were very welcomed by the Parisians, I have to say. They really enjoyed the show, so it was a pleasure to be there. And also, when we were in London, we played at the Royal Albert Hall, so we kind of ditched the tent for the Royal Albert Hall. And that, of course, has been a dream of mine since I was a kid to perform there, so it was, you know, truly an honor to perform there.
Nice. So does this particular production of Amaluna have a set run, or is it open-ended? Do you know when how much longer you're going to be doing it?
We'll see. Only time will tell. We go to Sacramento next after San Francisco.
So you'll have an opportunity through January 12th here by ATT Park, then moving up to Sacramento for a month in mid-January. Amanda Zidow, we really enjoyed the performance last night.
Thank you.
And I wish you a continued wonderful run. You'll also enjoy a rather impish lizard-like creature who wreaks havoc with audience members before the show begins. Fair warning, if you're in the front row with a bag of popcorn, it may be snatched from you and subsequently tossed back kernel by kernel from Lizard Boy.
That is true.
It's a lot of fun and would make for a terrific holiday outing option. Learn more through our website, klw.org. We'll have links to the production of Cirque du Soleil's Amaluna at ATT Park. We do have some music, the Tempest scene, which features you prominently. Tell us about that so we can...
So this is when my character, Prospera, I cause a storm out on the ocean in order for a ship to become shipwrecked that's full of men.
I kind of like that scene myself.
Oh, great. Yeah, it's a fun scene, right?
Amanda Zidow performing in Cirque du Soleil's Amaluna. Thanks for coming in, Amanda.
Thank you so much.
Blue cellist Amanda Zidow in the Tempest scene from Amaluna, Cirque du Soleil. Really a fun production to catch if you've got some folks in town for the holidays. Through the 12th of January here in San Francisco, then moves up to Sacramento. Well, now for something completely different. As they say at the San Francisco Symphony, we're being treated to the wonderful pianist artistry of Leif Ove Andsnes. He'll be performing Mozart's Piano Concerto No. 2 tomorrow and Saturday evening at 8, Sunday afternoon at 2. Manfred Honeck on the podium, and Bruckner's Fourth Symphony also part of the program. I caught up with Leif earlier this week at Davies Symphony Hall. Leif, welcome to Open Air.
Thank you very much. We were hoping to see parts at the beginning of 2019, but you had to bow out due to an elbow injury, I believe. How are things healing?
Very well. It was a result of a lot of concerts, and suddenly, you know, for the first time in my life, I had a strain injury, and it's a bit of a shock to me. I had to cancel 2 or 3 months of concerts. But today I'm actually happy that it happened, because I learned a lot. I got lessons in anatomy and from really great therapists, and now I know a lot more about my arms. It's about time when you're 49 and a pianist to get to know these things. And but it was tough last season. Now I'm much stronger, and I love being on stage again.
Gave you an opportunity to slow down things a little bit too, I imagine.
It did. And you know, it's remarkable when you talk with musicians. Most musicians will go in, get some problem at some point in the career, and one has to try to learn from it. You know, is there something you need to adjust, something you do a little bit wrong, muscles you could use more or less, or, you know. I feel like grateful that I got this opportunity to learn more.
And perhaps to spend some more time with your very young family.
Also, that was a bonus, yeah.
Well, this Mozart's Piano Concerto No. 22, written at a particularly challenging time financially for Mozart, around 1785, one of three concertos from that same year, yeah. When this 29-year-old composer was still trying to establish himself in Vienna, where he had moved a few years before, and was beseeching his publisher and others for money.
Yeah, and if it was money problem, so whatever. This is a special time. I don't know why it was so creative for him, but these years, 1785, 84, 86, he wrote incredible piano concertos. In 84 already, he wrote 6 piano concertos. And then when he starts with the D minor number 20 in 1785, beginning of 1785, it's like he suddenly expands the whole genre, and he separates the soloist more from the orchestra. So you feel the soloist is like an individual, and orchestra sometimes the society. I mean, you know, you can make stories or whatever, but there is, and he brings in more and more soloistic wind instruments. I believe this is the first concerto where he brings in the clarinet.
Mm-hmm. Well, as a flutist, I'm really enjoying the flute parts, and it seems like he took a lot of care in the woodwinds for these concerti.
Fantastic. I mean, more and more how he gives. I mean, in this concerto, in the second movement, there are long parts where I don't play. You know, it's just variations for different solo instruments in the wind section. It's tremendous how he expanded the genre of piano concerto in 2 or 3 years, from something which was very much more about dialogue all the time between the orchestra and the piano, to the beginning of what became the romantic piano concerto, which is this sort of heroic role of the soloist in a way. I mean, it's mostly about this great communication between the different instruments. I mean, there's such a fantastic operatic feeling in his piano concertos. But there is also the feeling that it gets more and more virtuosic. And I've been thinking now, studying this concerto again, how surprisingly virtuosic it is. It has certainly passages that could remind you of Liszt, you know. And you don't expect that from Mozart.
You're talking about variations in the work that the orchestra itself is doing. The great French composer Olivier Messiaen thought of the Andante movement as a series of variations on attitudes towards death, hopelessness, revulsion, oppression, celestial consolation, and certainty of rebirth, he writes. What, one man's opinion, or do you feel that as well? And do you see environmental factors like his finances or like his mortality coming into view in his writing?
I don't know if we can tell that this might be because of financial problems or mortality issues, or consciousness. But But certainly, I think Messiaen is right. I didn't know that he had these descriptions of these different variations, and I think that's very beautiful. I have been thinking myself that this is very much a movement about death, and at the end of the movement, there's a remarkable feeling of saying farewell, and it's one of his most touching pieces. It's incredible that he has this ability. His music is so much about beauty and about
simplicity.
Yeah, and entertainment also, just enjoyment. And then there are these moments of such loneliness, such darkness. Often in moments which are entertaining, there will be this short moments of darkness, and then there's suddenly that, like, a moment like this where there is so much drama, it's very, very spiritual music.
A couple of years ago, you embarked on a massive Beethoven journey of performance and recording, as well as video, now with Mozart. In fact, this Piano Concerto number 22 is slated to be recorded with the Mahler Chamber Orchestra, your collaborating ensemble for the Beethoven, for a future release on Sony Classical. Now, is this part of a grand scheme? Do you have other composers that you're going to treat similarly?
I don't know. I mean, this came as a result of our Beethoven journey, as we called it, between 2012 and 15 with the Mahler Chamber Orchestra, when I played repeatedly, you know, all the Beethoven concertos, and we recorded them. And I felt, especially the last year, that there was such a freedom and spontaneity in our concerts, and I was longing to make another project with them. And I'm leading from the keyboard. I did that with the Beethoven as well, so we don't have a conductor. And now we do a project called Mozart Momentum, where we choose these 2 years, actually 1785-86, and we play five piano concertos and also chamber music and solo piano music from the same years. And we'll do numerous concerts, and it can be curated in different ways. The orchestra sometimes play symphonies by Haydn or other composers from the same years, you know, so to have a comparison of what's happening. I really look forward to it, because they have a fantastic ensemble, and I love working in that intimate way with them.
Seems like a great collaborating partnership there.
Absolutely, and the opportunity to do it over a longer time. I mean, this project will also last until the end of 2022 or so. And I just know that, you know, when we have played again these pieces in different tours, that there's a different feel.
Speaking of the 22nd again, the piano concerto, you'll be doing this with Herbert Blomstedt, the San Francisco Symphony's conductor laureate, later in January with the Berlin Philharmonic. Who defers to whom in such a collaboration and interpretation with that eminence Grieg on the podium?
Who's first? Sorry.
Who defers to whom in terms of interpretation? I imagine you're learning something from Blomstedt and vice versa in your particular interpretation.
Certainly, I think, you know, sometimes it's a question of who's the strongest, but I think in this case, and certainly with Mozart, there's so much give and take in this music, and there are many parts where the soloist will be leading, other parts where certainly I will be very attentive to what the conductor is doing, and I always want to work with, you know, strong personalities, strong conductors, because I want to learn something new from them. Mm-hmm. And certainly with Mr. Blomstedt, who was the first conductor I worked with here in San Francisco. I think back in 1995, and that's also the first week that I met MTT, because he was at that concert.
Wow.
But that was the first time I worked with Blomstedt, and I've worked many times with him, and he is he's still going strong and so wonderful. Mm-hmm. And he has a sense of that music, a wonderful sense of Mozart. So I look forward to that. Always learning from him.
Bernard Honeck on the podium for this concert?
Manfred.
Manfred Honeck.
Sorry. Manfred Honeck is somebody I've been working with also several times, and maybe especially with Mozart, actually. He Yeah, I mean, he has this Viennese sense of Mozart, this sort of... He's very good at catching the different characters. I mean, Mozart can be elusive, but you have also to have a sense of which character you want. He is great with the string players to get them to play with different colors for different for the different passages. You know, the great thing in this music is that you will have four bars of one character, and then it is changing to something different. And Manfred is really a master in catching these small subtle changes and make them into different colors for the strings or in terms of character.
Do you have a favorite pianist interpreter of Mozart that you admire and that you've looked up to over the years?
I can't say I have one particular pianist from the past that I think of when it comes to Mozart, because there are, you know, everybody played Mozart, and there are some wonderful recordings by Schnabel or Michelangeli or whatever, but I'm not thinking of one pianist. You know, some of this music, Bach, Beethoven, Mozart, wasn't it Schnabel that said it's greater than it can ever be played? So there is this feeling also with a great pianist that as long as one can, one just try to reach the light in the end of the tunnel somewhere.
Do you have a particular piano of choice, or does it depend on the composer, or maybe it depends on if you have a relationship with a piano company? Mozart have better on a Steinway versus a Bösendorfer? Or?
I mean, these days, I mean, I do play normally on a Steinway, and I do prefer the Steinway, and that's especially in a bigger concert hall where you need this kind of glowing sound, which I think the Steinway has in a very unique way. You know, sometimes I wish that it was a bit more like 100 years ago when you had 7 or 8 companies that were all popular, and some pianists preferred this company to that, and they were more competing. Today, most of us rely very much on Steinway, and unfortunately they are there. I love that sound.
Did you hear that, Steinway? I think that counts as an endorsement. And have you, either out of curiosity or in performance, worked with early pianos just to see what composers were actually working with when they composed these works?
Absolutely. I have. I have not played much concerts on, certainly not on piano, not on pianos from Mozart's time. I played some concerts on pianos from the 19th century. When you get back to, you know, 1790s or 1780s, which was the time of Mozart, that's really a stretch from the modern piano. That is really a different piano. But we have to know about it, and we have to know how it sounded. So, but it is, of course, a very different thing to play it on modern instruments. I love listening to some recordings of older instruments, but on the other hand, to put a 1780 piano into Davis Hall, it wouldn't work.
Right.
You wouldn't project. I mean, these pianos were made for smaller rooms. Mm-hmm. They were, you know, one played these concertos for 200 or 300 people, mm-hmm. not for 2,000 people.
Which we hope we'll have for these performances. Thanks for taking some time, Leif.
Thank you. Pleasure.
Leif Ove Andes performs Mozart with the San Francisco Symphony. Manfred Onnick on the podium, also Bruckner's 4th Symphony as part of that equation. Well, piano of a different type to introduce this next segment, and Peter Robinson's contributions to this week. Play it, Sam.
You must remember this. A kiss is still a kiss. A sigh is just a sigh. The fundamental things apply as time goes by.
great Dooley Wilson from Casablanca for Peter's segment on a memoir. Speaking of memories.
Hi, David. Yeah, good to be here. And, of course, that is the immortal song, which conjures up all sorts of images. One question you may want to ask yourself, who were you with when you last saw Casablanca, or can't you talk about it? So that's the question. Thanksgiving is coming up. The family is around the table. Sometimes it's a happy get-together, and sometimes it indeed ends in disruption. But one thing's for sure, this could be just the right moment to consider writing a family memoir. And family memoirs have all the pros and cons that any good memoir have. But if you want to approach the subject, I think the first thing to do is to establish, of those friends, guests, family, uncles, aunts, sisters, brothers who are sitting around the table, who would agree to be interviewed. And I think that's where a family memoir begins. So if you're considering writing a family memoir, here are a couple of tips to help get you started. If you've established that at least some of your friends and family are willing to be interviewed, either later in the day or in the next few months, conduct the interview with a tape recorder. And one way I go about this is I divide my yellow pad into two sections. The left-hand section, I'm writing down the words, but I'm recording the voices and the sounds. And down the right-hand side, I'm looking at facial gestures, at art movements, hand movements, body movements, because sometimes words can say one thing and a face can say something totally different. So that's how I would get started. The second thing is, and it's a tough one to do, leave your judgment at the door. And I say that from personal experience. Many years ago when I was reviewing my sister's memoir, which came out both in this country and in the UK, my opening sentence was, "All memoirs are fiction." And that immediately got us off to a different start. And I throw that out because memory itself is a tricky business. And two people can grow up in the same house, have the same moments, the same incident, and lo and behold, a different interpretation. So don't be thrown when you ask a question about where were you when Jack Kennedy was assassinated, and you get two different answers from the same person, or where were you at the beginning of the Gulf War, or where were you when your grandfather died? All these can be turning points, and a good memoir essentially is about turning points. Let's get into the nature of family stories, and what ways can you invite or conjure up memories? Well, again, I found there's three or four things that do spark memories. And the first is music. You know, early on today, we were listening to a wonderful piece of Mozart. Before that, we were talking about Cirque du Soleil. And David even mentioned having a dream. So consider starting your daily journal. And in my daily journal, I include daydreams, and I include night dreams, and I include nightmares as well. In fact, I live in Marin, so it comes as no surprise that I belong to a dream group. So there we are, dreaming away. But the daily journal of incidents in your own life is another part of writing a good memoir, because I think one thing you'll discover as you go on this journey through your family's happenings is you will indeed be learning more about yourself. And a good memoir relates the writer, the narrator, to the people around him or her. Taste is a great source of memory. Those favorite foods you had when you grew up as a child, the change in diets, when things happened and how they didn't. And then fashion. What were you wearing and what were they wearing and how did clothes tell a story? So memorabilia becomes another factor in writing a memoir. And you might want to invite people to bring photos, wedding pictures, rings, jewelry, or if the person, for example, has been in the military, medals, the whole thing which takes you back to a certain moment in the past. And consider the fact that your memoir of the family may well be helping other people. Memoirs can be inspiring. They can show you how you thought about things, and they can also learn you, or teach you rather, how to craft a story, because we're interested in storytelling. But there's one thing I always recommend when it comes to memoir writing, and that is fact-checking. Recently, when I was running a memoir writing workshop, I had a happily married couple. They'd been married 35 years. I separated the husband from the wife, and I asked, "Where did you meet?" And the husband told me it was in Boston at the airport. The place was totally crowded, and the only seat available was next to her. And I asked the wife, "Where did you meet?" Again, she said, "Boston airport." And the place was totally empty, and he came and sat next to me. Now, both people were telling the truth, and I didn't doubt that for one second, but what I realize is perception and memory are indeed two different factors. So Thanksgiving may be just the right moment to start a memoir and craft it carefully. If any listeners want any guidelines or help, at the San Francisco Literary Society we are offering a memoir writing workshop, and the number to call for that is 415-381-6671.
We'll include a link at our website for that.
And talking about family memories, what better than to tune in to Series 3 of The Crown? Here we are back in the 60s. The program runs from 1964 to 1967. And Netflix did promise from the beginning they would have a change of cast. So the role of Queen Elizabeth, now in her mid-period, is played by Olivia Colman. And she brings a really steady production to a major change in terms of where we're going with the royal family. Joss O'Connor plays the Prince of Wales, and a delightful performance by Helena Bonham Carter as Princess Margaret. And this is a critical time in royal history. I lived through it, I remember it. The Queen is now much more in command. It's no longer the young monarch of the first two series. And Prince Philip, who's played by Tobias Menzies, is also going through a change in life. It's a period which runs from the beginning with the death of Winston Churchill and finishes with the final handover of power from Harold Wilson. Interesting, they give one particular series to an event which happened in Wales known as Abervan, and this is when a whole mining village collapsed and closed and killed many different people. And in real life, one of the Queen's greatest regrets is that she did not have more to say or sympathy to express for that particular loss. So they've given a full episode over to this, which I think is a good example of maybe learning history through movies. Sometimes, as a critic, making a judgment for me means not only what I see on the screen, but in a number of instances, I have seen or interviewed some of the real players, including Prince Charles, and I think they got the voice right. He still speaks like an Edwardian. I've also run into Camilla Parker Bowles, and believe it or not, was at school with her ex-husband, Colonel Parker Bowles. So you bring real life onto the screen and you get a really fine series. Congratulations to Netflix. I think the Series 3 of The Crown is a useful piece of history. It also gives us insight, whether you're a monarchist or not, as to the role that the Queen plays or did play in the late 60s and early 70s on what I consider to be an exceptional series.
Thank you for that endorsement, Peter, and I think we could use a strong monarch here, perhaps for a second term. Maybe the Queen's available. We'll see what happens for that.
Placement would work over here at the moment.
God Save the Queen, indeed, on Netflix and elsewhere. I'm sure you can catch the season 3 of the Crown. Other events happening this weekend we should be aware of. The San Francisco Opera Chorus under Ian Robertson is going to be at the Taube Atrium Theater tomorrow evening at 7:30. Always a wonderful chance to hear them. And the Capella SF is going to be performing on Saturday evening at the Church of Santa Maria in Orinda, and Sunday at Mission Dolores Basilica. Always wonderful to hear the work of Ragnar Bolin. Check those out, and everything else you've heard about here on Open Air. Links at our website, kalw.org. We'll be off next week for our annual presentation of Giving Thanks on Thanksgiving. And thank you for being a listener of Open Air and a supporter of KLW San Francisco. And thanks to, of course, Niels Swinkles for producing the show. Archived at klw.org. I'm David Latulip. David at klw.org is my web link. The BBC News is next for an hour here on KLW San Francisco.